Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, Professor Saeed Khan discusses 50 years since the fall of Saigon, the event that ended the Vietnam War on April the 30th, 1975. Professor Khan explores the global impact of the war's conclusion, the legacy of US involvement, and how its memory continues to influence contemporary geopolitics. Recorded live at the 2025 festival, this thought-provoking, insightful talk offers historical reflection and fresh perspective.
My name is Professor Saeed Khan, and I come to you by way of Wayne State University in Detroit. Always wonderful to come back to Bradford. Some of you have probably heard that I find Bradford to be a kindred spirit to my Detroit, a wonderful post-industrial city, the brunt of far too many national jokes, but we show them. This year, particularly with being the city of culture here, there's always an overabundance of culture in Detroit, so we don't have to really worry about that. Great food scenes in both places, by the way, which is why I swim before I come here in order to enjoy the food and burn the calories off later. Well, for some of you who've been coming to my lunchtime talks, you know I have something for anniversaries. Last year was the 50th anniversary of Watergate and Nixon's resignation, and the year before that was the 50th anniversary of Pink Floyd's iconic Dark Side of the Moon. Well, there's a lot of commemorations and observances which have far more profound and far more reaching import than sometimes we consider, even though it may not be necessarily apparent today. But I thought I would go ahead and focus on an anniversary which just occurred on April the 30th of this year, and that is typified by this image. Anyone familiar with this image? There you go. Oh my God, a Smith's Queen is Dead shirt. All right, we will talk later. My God, next year's going to be 40 years for the release. I can't believe I'm that old. Yeah. Well, no, but you also gave me an idea for next year's talk. This is, in fact, the U.S. Embassy on April the 30th, 1975 in Saigon, and is the CIA actually helping people evacuate? I'm pretty sure all of them didn't fit in that one helicopter, so this is probably a queue that was occurring. And I want you to think about this picture because I'm going to show some other images which hopefully will be pertinent and also symmetrical to history, and particularly how far we've come and how far we haven't. Well, the Americans left Saigon in 1975, and in fact, the name Saigon left as well. Hence, it was then renamed Ho Chi Minh City. But in order to talk about what are the consequences of Saigon 50 years on, it's always important to take a look back. And when you have a historian with a clicker, you know you're going to go back. So let's go not all the way back, because that would be not only a very long lecture, but one that I think deserves its own meditation. The period of Vietnam prior to colonialism. Sometimes we forget that these civilizations and these societies have thousands of years of history, ones that were very vibrant, ones that were very culturally efflorescent. And I certainly invite any and all of you to go and explore Vietnamese history back then. In particular, because when it comes to East Asia, Vietnam unfortunately tends to get lost in other very vibrant cultures like Japan and China and India. Wedged in between all of them, of course, is Vietnam and more broadly Indochina. But I imagine that part of the reason also for our lack of familiarity, or relatively speaking, is because the French were involved in Vietnam. It might have been a completely different discussion and a different level of frame of reference had it been part of the British Empire. But the French never wanted to get left out. They were certainly rivals of the British colonial project, perhaps a little bit of envy as well. And so they reach Indochina in 1858 under Napoleon III. And the colonial period begins after its conquest. And it lasts from 1862 to World War I. Now, what's interesting is that in 1940, the Japanese invade and take over Vietnam, where you had actually an emperor, and they keep the Vichy regime that the French had installed as a puppet regime. Remember, in France, with the advent of World War II, there was a replacement of the government and the installation of the Vichy regime, which, of course, was loyal to Berlin. Well, similarly, then, the French were required by the Germans to install similar governments around their colonial project. Syria and Lebanon, for some of you who were at the lecture a few days ago, we talked about that as well. There was an emperor at this time, a Vietnamese emperor by the name of Bao Dai. And as was commonplace with the French, they looked for, and I know it's a terrible word to use, essentially puppets or those who tended to be rather complicit and quiescent in their colonial strategies and their priorities. And Bao Dai had developed a sufficient affinity for the French and probably an equally efficient contempt for his own people. And you can always tell when it comes to photographs. Here he is in, I have to imagine it's not off the rack, a bespoke suit. And the fact that his own apparel and own culture is something that he abdicated far before he did the throne of Vietnam. Now, in 1945, when Japan surrenders, we also find the abdication of Bao Dai himself. And in many ways, this is a moment that creates a political vacuum in Vietnam, but it also creates an opportunity for those who are seeking a new and perhaps, hopefully, a post-colonial Vietnam. On September the 2nd of 1945, and realize, of course, that the Japanese surrendered on August the 9th of 1945, so this is not a very long time frame that transpires, we have Ho Chi Minh, who is the leader of the Viet Minh, declaring independence for Vietnam. Would that it was that simple that an indigenous Vietnamese person could go ahead and declare independence and people would leave the place well enough alone. Well, that wasn't really the case either for the French or in this case for the British, that both of which opposed this assertion that was made by Ho Chi Minh. Now, part of this is you're wondering, well, why would the British be two things, opposed to independence here and actually being on the same side of something with the French? This can most easily be explained from the fact that both the British and the French were worried that Vietnam would be the first domino to fall in what would then be a process of decolonization. It was quite clear after World War II that the British and the French were having, how can we call this, a cash flow problem, and that there was a possibility that they were going to have to jettison some of these colonial projects around the world. They had to decide which ones, perhaps in which order, as well as in which manner. The other issue, of course, was a matter of morale and saving face. I remember reading Salman Rushdie said that the British left India for many reasons, but one of them wasn't out of embarrassment or shame. The whole idea that Gandhi simply lay in front of enough trains to shame the British or to guilt the British to leave, that simply wasn't the case. It became just economically cumbersome for the British to have that. Has anyone read the books by David Canaston, by any chance, on Britain after post-World War II? After World War II? They're really good, and they're really thick, but they are a vibrant social history of the UK in this very pivotal period. It helps explain why Churchill, for example, the war hero, loses to the Labour Party and Clement Attlee coming. I was shocked to hear for how long ration cards were still used in England, well past 1945. So it just gives you an indication of what were the economic dire straits happening at the time. So the British decided that they were going to join with the French in order to then suppress colonial movements, which could then create aspirations not only elsewhere within the French colonial system, but then also would have a trickle effect into the British system. For those of you who want me to blow the plot for you, it didn't work because decolonization ended up happening. But it was a painful and a brutal process that then led to the French Indochina War from 1945 to 1954. Okay. Well, this is Uncle Ho. I don't mean to be disrespectful. That's literally what he was known as. I think Gen Z would think it means something else today. And since I don't see any Gen Z people here, I can tell because no one's snickering. But this is Ho Chi Minh. And I was also struck by the fact that he was alive while I was alive. I was born in 1967, and Ho Chi Minh died in 1969, because sometimes we lose track of the scope of history. And I didn't realize that for a brief moment, he and I were contemporaries, certainly on the back end for him and on the front end for me. Well, he was the first president of the Democratic Republic of Vietnam, and in fact served as such for the rest of his life. What I found fascinating about Ho Chi Minh was not that he was just some kind of old or avuncular figure, as most of us knew him who are either students of or who lived through the Vietnam conflict era, but he was quite a traveler. And he was a traveler because he was a cook on ships. And in fact, he was also a dishwasher in restaurants. And at one time, he was also a pastry chef in France. Well, he happened to be in France at the very moment of the Paris Peace Conference in 1919, when, of course, the fate of the world was being discussed there. Except, of course, none of the defeated powers were invited, the Ottoman Empire, Austria-Hungary, or Germany. But there was this groundswell of hope and optimism, particularly by those who were under colonial rule. Part of this was instigated, whether it was inadvertent or intentional, by President Woodrow Wilson of the United States, who shows up in Paris with what are known as the 14 points. One of them was self-determination. And it's remarkable how many people were there and who was inspired. It's like people who went to the Woodstock Festival in 1969, the year that Ho Chi Minh died. And by the way, Woodstock didn't kill Ho Chi Minh. But the fact that I've met people who've been at Woodstock always amazes me with the stories. And there were supposedly three babies born at Woodstock, and so far I've met four people who said they were born there. So you do the math. But Nehru was there. Ho Chi Minh was there. And so you can then think that perhaps there was some kind of osmosis that was occurring at the promise, even if it didn't necessarily transpire at the time. Ho Chi Minh was politically active at this time as a very young man of about, gosh, maybe, was that 19 years of age, 29 years of age. And he, in fact, provided a petition to the Paris Peace Conference, trying to then either get some time on the agenda or making the case for an independent Vietnam, which of course was rebuked almost immediately. But that did not stop Ho Chi Minh from really leaning into the idea of decolonization within Vietnam itself. And he was responsible for the Viet Minh not only declaring Vietnamese independence, but fighting the French colonial rule there. And it was a grinding war that lasted about 9 years and culminated with, of course, the very significant defeat of the French forces at Dien Bien Phu. With the defeat of the French, there was then an imperative to have a peace conference, and that peace conference was held in Geneva. However, things weren't very smooth. Instead of having a unified Vietnam, something that Ho Chi Minh sued for, the French simply couldn't leave without there being some future of discord and division. And so they decided to partition the territory along the 17th parallel, where you had the Viet Minh stronghold in the north, and then you had in the south, South Vietnam, the area of sort of a nascent post-French colonial democratic regime that the French or others could go ahead and support. Mind you, of course, this is 1954. It is in the midst of the Cold War. It is in the midst of the Red Scare. There is neighboring China. And certainly in the West, and more certainly within the United States and the Eisenhower regime, how to deal with the specter of communism. Now, the policymaker George Kennan had said the way to do this is containment. And so in the mind of people like Eisenhower, containment meant trying to provide support that would create a firewall, even when it came to civil wars that were underway. In that sense, the United States essentially inherited what the French left behind. And you saw that this was a process that was happening in many places when it came to containment. The so-called Eisenhower Doctrine then created CENTO, the Central Nations Treaty Organization, which included the British, the Americans, Pakistan, Iran, Iraq, and Turkey, intended to form sort of a southern girdle from the possibility of Soviet expansion further to the south. His predecessor, President Harry Truman, had his own doctrine. Everybody gets a doctrine, apparently, which was to contain the possibility of communism spreading into Greece after World War II, because there was a civil war going on here. Well, when civil war then breaks out in 1954, because there is no consensus about a unified Vietnam, we find that the United States intervenes. Well, at this point, and if you were to read American history books about it, it was that the U.S. was providing advice to South Vietnam. Well, that advice was not academicians, and it was not policymakers. The advisors were military advisors. I have a feeling they were probably dressed differently than I was. But this then marks the beginning of American intervention in Southeast Asia. Eisenhower leaves office in 1960. He's term limited out, but he warns everyone, beware of the military-industrial complex and how this then might draw people into war. And boy, did it. You had the 1964 Gulf of Tonkin incident, which is still highly debated about whether this was a sufficient provocation for greater military involvement. I can tell, sir, from your response that you don't necessarily believe the official American position. This is Secretary of Defense Robert McNamara, who, by the way, had the slickest hair ever, showing a map. And the reason that I put this graphic is I am sure that you have seen several maps that have been used to justify military intervention, whether that was the maps used by then National Security Advisor Colin Powell to justify the 2003 Iraq invasion, or if it was Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel showing the rather cartoonish bomb at the United Nations General Assembly saying that Iran is only weeks away from a bomb, and that was, I think, 8 years ago. I always think that people should wear a clock so that they have a true sense of time. But Tonkin was a moment, and you did then see greater military incursion into the war. By this time in 1964, of course, it was Lyndon Baines Johnson. 1968 seems to have caught the Americans off guard with the Tet Offensive, Tet being, of course, a celebration of the new year in Vietnam, caught them flat-footed. But it was definitely a major uptick in the hostilities. One of the aspects of the war that also needs to be considered, though, is the illegal wars that were underway. And by the time 1968 is over, as you probably recall or have read about, Johnson said, I don't want any more of this. And in fact, he announces in the spring of 1968 that he shall not seek, nor shall he accept, the nomination of his party for president moving forward, which then sends the political and electoral choice process into turmoil in the Democratic Party. I'm sure back then they said this would never happen again, until, of course, last year when we found that President Biden similarly pulled out of the nomination for his party. When this happens, though, and with the election of Nixon in 1968, there is more of an impetus for covert action. And the war then expands to neighboring countries like Cambodia, which of course then destabilized them and helped bring in such regimes as Pol Pot with the Khmer Rouge. There are peace accords, and ones that certainly are codified in Paris by 1973, but the conflict continues for another year and a half. Finally, by 1975, the United States has decided under President Ford that the country cannot bear to continue this conflict. In part, and ironically, it was because of the collective trauma felt by the resignation of Richard Nixon prior to that. It was felt that there were just simply too many controversies going on. Something had to give. And in this case, it was evacuating from Saigon, which was the last proverbial nail in the coffin. But I wanted to put up these statistics for you because sometimes we forget just simply how grave the numbers were. 58,000 American troops, 300,000 wounded. On the North Vietnamese side, just simply within the military, 850,000 killed, 600,000 wounded, and 180,000 civilians from the North. As far as South Vietnamese, we have 430,000 killed, but 1.1 million wounded, and 313,000 civilians were killed along with that. The numbers are just simply sobering. And certainly within the American context, one doesn't really hear about the latter two numbers with any level of attention that we hear the first. Today, if you go to Washington, D.C., you will see Maya Lin's incredible Vietnam Memorial, which has the 58,000 names etched in it in simple black marble. The aftermath of the war, of course, within Vietnam was quite devastating. In some cases, people could argue whether this was a Pyrrhic victory or not. Here you see the carnage, you see the devastation in a city like Saigon. But I also wanted to show you another image, which was part of the aftermath. The Hoa, or the Vietnamese who were part of what became known as the boat people. And this was not a small number. Estimates are somewhere along the lines of 800 to 850,000 people then set sail, however they could, to go wherever they could. Going to places like Hong Kong, the Philippines, elsewhere within Southeast Asia, any place that they could go to escape the devastation and the rather bleak outlook for what lay ahead to Vietnam. Because when the United States left, there simply really was not any kind of support system. North Vietnam won, they overran South Vietnam, but the economics of the country were ones that rebuilding was paramount without any kind of external help really being possible. But this is Vietnam today. And in fact, this is Ho Chi Minh City itself, which is just simply vibrant. Amjad, have you been to, you have? Okay. And you can testify to that? Okay, good. You can also testify to the fact that I didn't erroneously put a slide of Hanoi instead of Ho Chi Minh City. Hanoi is the capital now, of course, of Vietnam, with a population of the country being about 100 million. It has a gross domestic product of just slightly less than half a trillion. And by the way, it's the 33rd largest economy in the world. It has certainly bounced back in the last 50 years. It is considered to be one of the Asian tigers. A GDP growth rate, which I guess in the United States these days, we would metaphorically press our nose to the window, looking inside and saying, boy, I wish we had one of those. 6.5% is quite impressive. And a per capita income per year of $14,000. Well, what are the lessons that we can learn from the Vietnam conflict, and particularly after the fall of Saigon? I would argue that it changed America rather profoundly. America was not used to losing. If you think about all of the wars that had led up to it, America had a fairly decent track record, whether it was the American Revolutionary War. I don't know if the Civil War really counts. I mean, part of America won and part of it lost. I suppose maintaining the Union was a good thing overall, although that's always teetering these days. The Mexican War before that, the Spanish-American War in 1898, being on the winning side of World War I, World War II, the Korean conflict, which actually, not to ruin people's moods, ended in really a stalemate. But Vietnam was the first clear moment of the American military suffering a defeat in an asymmetric war. Here you find that the Viet Minh, although they were well equipped with fighter jets and other munitions, certainly weren't capable of having B-52s or some of the other firepower that the United States did. But if you look beyond this, again, the Cold War has not ended. And so you have other conflicts in the world, including in Central America, including in Africa, particularly with Angola and Mozambique, and then also in places like Afghanistan 4 years later. I mean, sometimes it blows my mind that Afghanistan started only 4 years after Vietnam ended. Nonetheless, we find that the United States is now fairly well affirmed that direct conflict with the Soviet Union is no longer an option. And at this moment, coalitions really aren't being built either. And so the other option that the United States has is proxy wars, going ahead and funding and supporting local groups like the Contras in Nicaragua against the Sandinista regime of Daniel Ortega, providing munitions by way of South Africa to the people fighting SWAPO, the Southwest Africa People's Organizations in places like Angola and Mozambique. And then, of course, perhaps most famously, supplying weapons to the Mujahideen, the Afghan freedom fighters from 1979 to 1989. Not only did they supply them with the weapons, they also framed the war as a religious imperative. The word Mujahideen was not something that was self-defined by the movement. It was decided by then National Security Advisor Zbigniew Brzezinski in order to contrast the godly to the godless Soviets. After the Cold War ends, we have conflicts in Iraq, the second incarnation of a long continuing conflict in Afghanistan, which started in 1979, and then more recently, I would argue, in Iran with the American strikes after the Israeli attacks on nuclear sites over there. And we saw, of course, this whole idea of coming up with creative names like the Coalition of the Willing and the Coalition of the Not So Ambivalent, or I don't know what they necessarily were at the time. Another manifestation and legacy left behind from this, of course, was refugees. Vietnam showed the magnitude of refugees, including boat people, as they were known, and trying to go ahead and deal with this influx of people in other areas. There was also, though, something that was lost in the narrative, and that was the internal displacement within Vietnam itself. Of millions of people now that have been uprooted, both at the time of a conflict which had been raging since, well, let's face it, 1945 until 1975, over a generation. But certainly even in the aftermath of war, when retribution and revenge are there, internal displacement was an issue. And then, of course, there's transnational migration. And think about, for example, the imagery that we have seen recently about people who are trying to cross the English Channel, the influx of refugees into Europe, other areas of the world when it comes to this, particularly when we saw the civil war in Syria, 3 million refugees being absorbed into Turkey, 1 million into Lebanon, which increased the population of Lebanon by 25%. How to then look at refugees? Are they a commodity? Are they a constant reminder of shame, of defeat? Are they a reminder of complicity in the colonial or the post-colonial era or from some kind of military intervention? Another factor was public protests. If you think about Vietnam, I think it is impossible not to think about the images of people taking to the streets. In 1968, for example, on the steps of the U.S. Embassy at Grosvenor Square in London, you have images of Tariq Ali with a bullhorn standing next to Bertrand Russell, standing next to Vanessa Redgrave, inspiring Mick Jagger enough to write the song Street Fighting Man about him. Well, at least something good came out of it. But the fact that this mass mobilization of the public was seen as a threat to the policymakers. There was also, along with this, perhaps a dimension of public protest, the idea of media. In the United States in 1968, perhaps the most influential and most trusted voice was the CBS News anchor Walter Cronkite. And Cronkite got on the news, and by the way, once upon a time, there was news 6:30 in the evening, not 24 hours a day. Oh, I'm sorry, I'm feeling a bit nostalgic here. And he came on the news and said that the Vietnam War is unwinnable. And when he said that, Lyndon Johnson in the White House said, expletive deleted, if Cronkite says it, we've lost the war. And it influenced his decision not to run for office again. Well, for those who have, let's say, a vested interest in war and conflict, they realize then that they have to temper not only the media, but they also have to temper public support and the groundswell. And certainly we have seen many examples of people taking to the streets recently over Gaza, but also 22 years ago when it came to Iraq. And it's always interesting to see how governments then respond to this. They have learned, perhaps, that they can weather the storm, at least temporarily, or find new mechanisms on how to then deal with their own people voicing this kind of opposition. Another casualty, I would argue, of the war is the whole idea of public disclosure and also the use of deception. Today, the media and technology and communications are far different than they were when we only had a half hour news in the evenings. And it seems as though governments have decided, instead of learning something positive from this, they've just decided that even in democratic systems, it's better to conceal or it's better to defraud. We've seen the whole narrative during Iraq of weapons of mass destruction. We have seen more recently the whole narrative of Iran being weeks away from going military capable with a nuclear device, something which actually has been said for the last 30 years. But this has become now a modus vivendi used by governments, something learned from the aftermath of Vietnam. I also notice in the United States that when troops came back from Vietnam, they were in many ways shunned. They were seen by some as an embarrassment because of the defeat, and by others, they were seen as having fought an illegitimate war. Today in America, militarization of civil society has become pervasive and quite totalistic. The very idea that any sporting event or major sporting event has a military flyover, I haven't understood, and I understand that the Super Bowl is basically like the Hajj of American civil religion. But the very idea that you have a B-2 bomber, by the way, the same ones that were used by the United States and Iran last week, are flying overhead. I'm not sure what the correlation is with the military and the football game, unless you think that this is a pseudo-gladiator thing of two armies fighting. But I find it even weirder that you have a military flyover when they're playing in a domed stadium. I don't know. I don't always get all the memos. But this whole idea now of the narratives of support our troops. When I was boarding my flight to come to Bradford in the United States, they say, you know, first class and then active military get to board next as a priority. And I'm like, okay, what? These kinds of like little things. And of course, if you're the kind of person who's like, wait a minute, we live in a civilian society. Why are you giving this kind of thing? You will be the one who is ostracized now. So the culture of the country has changed, perhaps out of an atonement for how the troops were treated before. And this includes complicity by legislatures. Nobody wants to deny the military, whether it's the troops or whether it's the policymakers, anything when it comes to the authorization of military action. We saw this with President Trump. On whose authority did he decide to go ahead and attack a country that did not pose a threat and with which we were not at war? Notwithstanding that he has a slight majority in the House of Representatives, there was really no opposition by the Democratic side of the aisle either. The normalization of atrocities, the My Lai massacre, I won't go into the detail of this, was rather brutal. And it was thanks to whistleblowers, those with a conscience within the military who bore witness to this, who then testified about it. But nothing much has really been learned since My Lai. All that has happened is that laws have been written in order to justify action after that. There was no moral hazard and there was no legal liability for those who committed the atrocities in the Abu Ghraib prison and elsewhere in Iraq. And Abu Ghraib was the only one we know about. Similarly, Guantanamo. The only thing that changed was semantics. It's no longer torture, it is enhanced interrogation technique. It's no longer waterboarding, it's a liquid bath or whatever it is. That is another casualty. There's also the idea of the referendum on international law. The Geneva Convention, the Genocide Conventions, those conventions and agreements that were designed by the West to prevent further actions and atrocities to occur are either defied, avoided, ignored, or selectively used. Along with that comes the organizations themselves. The United Nations may prove to be inconvenient. NATO may be the better option depending on where the membership is there. But the International Criminal Courts, the International Courts of Justice, we know with what is happening today that these organizations are under threat and being undermined by the very architects of them themselves. So again, something to give pause of what is happening in the world. I look at the legacy of Saigon's fall through images, and here you see, with the exception of this being in black and white, these were protesters taking to the streets in 1968 in New York City. And apart from the fashion and the haircuts and the horn-rimmed glasses, which, by the way, are coming back in style, here you see an image of 22 years ago protesting the eventual Iraq invasion. And then here you see more recently from last year in just off Oxford Circus, I think. Is that? Anyway, London with the protesters regarding what's happening in Gaza. And here are a couple of other, I think, very sobering images. The first image I showed you was people being evacuated from the roof of the U.S. Embassy in Saigon on April the 30th of 1975. This is August of 2021 of a rather clumsy evacuation attempt in Kabul, Afghanistan. People literally handing their children to U.S. troops to try to have them extricated from the country for a better life. And then this is an image of people trying to cross the English Channel more recently as refugees. And here you see a naval patrol boat essentially looking to prevent that from happening. And I think about the 50 years between Saigon falling and now. And as I said, this could have been 1975, but it's 2021. This could have been 1975, but it's 2024. And we wonder really how far the world has come and what we really have learned from Saigon. Thank you. I have time for about 5 minutes of questions. So if anyone has a question, I think we have a mic. Yes.
I grew up south of the border and I do...
I'm sorry, could you tell us which border?
All right, sorry. The United States. So I was in Mexico. Okay. And I was about 9, 10, 11. And I think I can remember American parents being really worried about their children being brought into the draft. And it was the first time that we'd actually seen combat troops and what was happening. And I just wondered if you could just build on how the psyche of America changed as a result of seeing their military being sadly slaughtered in the manner that it was. Thank you.
No, thank you for the question. Let me ask the question. Does America have a draft right now? There's definitely a correlation there. I mean, I remember having to sign up for the Selective Service just in case. But remember, the Cold War wasn't over. There was still the possibility that we would have to go to war. I think two things change the way that Americans perceive this. I think you're absolutely right. The trauma of Vietnam was one of them, but also the inequality and the injustice by which the draft actually was being procured. The elite seemed to be able to get away with it, either if they had bone spurs or other maladies, that whether they were substantiated or not. Creedence Clearwater Revival wrote a wonderful song called Fortunate Son about this, which for some inexplicable reason, the current president of the United States used as his walk-up music. You know, if there's one thing that we have that's tariff-free in America, it's irony. So, yeah. And I'm sorry, the other part of the question was?
Just really how the psyche, how it changed America.
Well, I mean, I wonder when it came to Iraq, I thought maybe there would be another similar moment. Because one of the things that we saw in the Iraq conflict was not the number of people who died. It was actually the number of troops that survived but had catastrophic injuries. And so from that, the actual visibility of war came into a different kind of specific relief. Remember, in Vietnam, there were body bags that were coming back. Many people were missing and are still missing. So there was an invisibility that was involved. Today, the way that the government does, unless, of course, it wants the optics, is you don't see the bodies coming back. It is highly orchestrated. So you will find that there's a more clandestine operation in these very limited centers where the bodies are brought back in caskets. Or if it is something that can be leveraged politically, you'll find a president who will go there and who will receive the bodies at Dover Air Force Base. Trump, by the way, is notoriously allergic to this. Despite the bombast of patriotism and making America great again, he doesn't really like going to Arlington National Cemetery and other things. He's actually very, very military averse. But he also recognizes the power of the narrative that's going on there. So, thank you.
Have you watched the Vietnam War documentary by Ken Burns?
Yes. And thank you for raising that. If you ever get a chance, first of all, let me give a stunning endorsement for anything Ken Burns. His documentaries are phenomenal, whether it's the American Civil War, baseball. I know those are a little bit American-centric, but his series on Vietnam is really, really excellent. There are a few other documentaries that the names escape me right now that have provided interviews of the people. It reminds me a lot of the Ken Burns series of The World at War that was narrated by Sir Laurence Olivier. The ability to go ahead and ask the tough questions. There's a series or a show in America put on by public television called Frontline. Frontline's documentaries on Vietnam are fantastic as well. And I think now, 50 years on, people feel a little bit more comfortable talking about it, and I think being a bit more critical about it. The trauma of Vietnam, although perhaps will never go away, but it has dissipated to the point where people can articulate things that they didn't before. Last two questions, yep.
I was about 9 years old, I think, and I remember seeing there's news about the bombing of Hanoi.
Yeah.
How did the Americans go from that to 3 years later losing the whole war? Because they seem to be sort of bombing Hanoi flat in 72 or 73 or something.
Correct. So, I mean, even though it was a breach of the Paris Peace Accords, and it was a naked breach of the Paris Peace Accords, I mean, the only person who I think came out like a bandit was Kissinger, who got the Nobel Peace Prize for it. But don't worry, Trump might in October for solving the India-Pakistan thing that he didn't. There were two things that were going on. I think that there was this last push that the U.S. was trying to make, which still was being countered by the defiance of the North Vietnamese army. I mean, the carpet bombing of Hanoi was just brutal. I mean, to remind you of, for example, Tokyo in 1945 or Dresden in the similar year, but they just kept coming. And the other, I would argue, was political. Ford said, someone has to turn the lights off, and he did. Last question.
Do you think that current refugee crisis has got something to do with the evils, I'm not sure if that's the right word, evils of capitalism, like the way the capitalistic world shows to the rest of the world the glamorous lifestyle that it has, and it basically creates this urge for people to move abroad. Do you think it has got some sort of correlation to the capitalism?
I think that economics as a whole perhaps has something to do with it. I'm not sure if capitalism per se is the main driving force, for the simple reason that people who are leaving trauma don't necessarily care where they're going. It's more of a concern about what they're leaving. And if the system that they're going to, I mean, if China was to let them in, they would go to China. If they were to go to Sweden and Sweden was letting them in, they would go to Sweden. I don't think that capitalism per se necessarily drives it. There is a conceit that capitalism provides more economic opportunity, or it provides more economic stability. But I'm pretty sure that someone who is in a raft in the English Channel or somebody who is escaping Vietnam in 75 on a boat isn't reading The Economist or the Financial Times to say, which are the top 10 markets to go to? Yeah. All right. Thank you so much for being here. And I hope you enjoy the rest of the festival. And I'm sure I'll probably see you between now and when Saima turns the lights out on Sunday night.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.